Okay, this is the hour I call Conversations with Linda. We'll take your phone calls. Perhaps you've got some great story ideas for her. All of that next on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Linda Moulton Howe with us. Your phone calls for the hour. Linda, last weekend I had a major event in Boise, Idaho, and guess who they asked about?
That's where I was born and raised.
Did you ever get out there?
I was born and raised in Boise, Idaho.
But have you been there since?
I spent so much of my life in and around the whole state because my dad was director of aeronautics, and we flew everywhere, every nook and cranny. And then to put myself through college, I entered those various contests. So I was Miss Boise and Miss Idaho and in the Miss America pageant. And that put me through school, and a lot of people still know me from those days. And then I have been back periodically, sometimes even on some research. There have been some extraordinary events that have taken place in Idaho related to the UFO phenomena, and I have investigated some things there.
It is a gorgeous city.
Oh, yeah.
And clean.
Very clean.
I had a joke that somebody dropped a paper wrapper, and before it hit the ground, somebody else had caught it.
That's true. And the hills all around. I spent my both childhood and through junior high and high school hiking with friends up in those hills. And when you think back, the contrast to today, we could decide that we were going to go for lunch and pack some sandwiches and go all day and climb hills. And our parents didn't have to worry. And we never worried, and we had free lives all over those hills in Boise.
I love it. So you've got a lot of people lining up here to talk to you. I don't want to waste much time. Let's go right to them. Christian in Los Angeles, get us started. Hi, Christian.
Hey, how you guys doing? Hello, George. It's glad that I was able to have my chance to call and talk to Linda. It's been a long time since I've spoken to you, Linda. How are you?
And who am I listening to?
Christian. From Los Angeles.
Oh, okay.
How you doing, hon? You do a great job, and thank you for all the investigative work that you do, and keep at it.
Thank you.
My question to you is that since the Fukushima disaster has completely dropped off the radar of the corporate-controlled media, like CNN, for example, there's not a word is mentioned of it, and the only information I get, basically, is from you guys at Coast to Coast. The question I have is that since it is out of control and this, the radiation is just spewing into the Pacific at an alarming rate, the question I have is, since I'm a resident of Los Angeles and I live close to the beach, like the Santa Monica Beach, during the summer I like to go swimming a lot and spend time on the sand, you know, and get that, you know, traditional California tan, as it were. How safe would it be to spend a day at the beach, like at Santa Monica, and to even swim and dunk yourself in the ocean if the radiation levels are this dangerous, and especially with what happened with the crew of the USS Ronald Reagan? In your opinion, I mean, is it going to be safe to go swim and spend a day at the beach?
Yes.
Even eating seafood? And I'll take my question off the air, and I'll wait for the answer.
Yeah.
And you guys keep up the good work.
Thank you. When we're talking about the USS Reagan and the massive doses of radiation, that was 3 years ago after March 11th when the tsunami and quake ended up destroying and damaging a lot of the Fukushima TEPCO plant, and there were the three core meltdowns. That was the gigantic release of radiation into the air that wafted over the USS Reagan and everybody who was there. And then we've had high amounts of water coming out of the wastewater tanks that have been trying to cool these three melted cores for the last 3 years. And TEPCO can't keep up with the amount of radioactive water. And this is a problem because now a lot of it is going into the Pacific. But the distance between Japan, where that irradiated water is going out into the Pacific there, and the Los Angeles and California, Oregon, Washington, and Canada coasts is a massive distance separated by a massive volume of water. And the assumption is currently that there has been enough water to basically divide out whatever was radioactive water coming in, so it is not intense when it gets to the coast. But July is going to be a real test. There will be debris that has been moving across the Pacific Ocean, and it will now start clumping up against the west coast of the United States. It's my understanding that we have agencies that are going to be trying to measure that radioactivity. And if there was anything that was very much above what is accepted as normal, which is not a lot, then it may be that there might be some beach closures for a while, and there may have to be some special trash handling of this debris. We don't know yet. July will be that month. But keep in mind that it's a timeline. The massive amount of radiation that left the coast of Japan went out over the USS Reagan and all those horrible stories that Attorney Bonner was talking about in the first and second half hour, and why he is leading a class action lawsuit on behalf of those sailors and the Marine. That's 3 years ago. So in the timeline of intense radiation, that's not occurring. But what is occurring is the fact that there are three melted cores right now in Fukushima. The only way to keep them controlled in any way is to keep putting these massive amounts of cooling water on them.
Dangerous.
And they have not even started to dismantle one yet. When that starts, it's going to be precarious. And they're already estimating that it will take decades, that's the word, decades, to accomplish this dismantling of these three melted down radioactive cores. In the meantime, what does happen in the earthquake-prone Japanese area? If there is another large earthquake and it should tear into any of those already melted down cores that they're just trying to contain with water, what would the consequence be next? So we are, no one is out of the woods on Fukushima. And we are talking about a story that it seems to me that CNN and Fox and networks should be trying to do updates on this as regularly as I try, because this affects all of us. This affects the whole planet. This affects the marine life, the animal life, the plant life, the human life on Japan intensely, and it affects the rest of us because the questions still are hanging out there. Should power on this planet look to being dependent upon nuclear power plants? There have been arguments for, because some people argue that the engineering on nuclear power plants in 2014 is far superior to what it was in when TEPCO was built and some of the reactors in the United States. But there's no guarantee. And it seems to me that there is a growing consensus on many parts of the planet that nuclear power reactors are too dangerous to depend on them and to start a whole new wave of building them. And that's part of the slow motion car and train crash of Fukushima. Japan right now is being pressured to get right back to have, and TEPCO wants to get those reactors operating, even with those three melted down cores. Why? Because the Japanese government loaned them lots and lots of money to do what has been happening. So money is pressing the TEPCO corporation, which is a $1 trillion corporation, to get back into business. And it seems to me that the entire world community needs to say, or help Japan say, let's slow down, forget debt and the money, put the emphasis on what should we be doing with Earth life in the face of radiation from nuclear power reactors.
Linda, it's an incredible story. It's a sad story. It's a dangerous story.
That's right.
Next up. Let's go to Catherine, Santa Maria, California, first-time caller. Hi, Catherine. Go ahead.
Yes, hello. Thanks so much for you guys speaking about the things that you are talking about, because it's really touched on some things that's happened to me. About a year and a half ago, I think it was around June, in the southern part of Santa Maria, I and my family was called to live at the moon. My niece lives up in Eureka. And so we went outside, and where we live is in a cul-de-sac, which is kind of higher up elevation, a little bit higher up. And the moon was behind the trees, and it was a beautiful 7 o'clock p.m. night. Well, anyways, my sister and my niece and my nephew went back in the house to finish cooking. They were making ribs. I had noticed that my windows needed to be rolled up. Well, when I went to the car and I was in the car, I felt this compelling feeling to look straight up, and there was three red round lights. One in the middle was like winking at me. And I was starting to feel playful, like, come on, you guys are helicopters. What's up? There's an airport we have just right around the corner. Come on, you guys are just waiting. You guys aren't anything. Come on. But I kept feeling, no, they're communicating with me. There's something about it. So I went in the house to get my sister and my niece and my nephew to come out and confirm it. And I had told them there was three. But when they came out, there was only two. And they were, like, amazed, too. But they ran back in the house. I finished rolling up my windows, and I just felt like, this is interesting. Because this cul-de-sac is usually something is going on. There's either a car going down the street, somebody's checking the mail, because there's, like, a local mail spot where you have your key and you get your mail, or somebody's pulling in or something. And it was just extremely quiet. Like, it was just for me. My heart started racing, and I just felt nothing but happiness. It wasn't like a fearful feeling. So I ran back in the house and said, oh, my gosh, you know, this is crazy. You guys, you know, look, now they're gone. And I couldn't believe it. I mean, they just disappeared right in front of my eyes. I mean, I looked everywhere. The one in the middle that was winking at me was just amazing. And then the other two disappeared shortly after that. And so they came out. They confirmed it. I had been taking care of my nephew. He was just really rambunctious. He wouldn't be doing his homework for days. He was so excited. He said, Catherine, Aunt Kathy, I know that they were here for you.
Huh.
He went and got his homework. He was amazed. He was just like on cloud nine all night. And I had always felt this really special feeling. This was like, I think, right before the Mayan calendar thing was supposed to happen. So, I mean, I've had a lot of things that has happened to me in my life where I have done automatic writing and metaphysical things. And about 12 years ago, I did do some automatic writing, and it was something about the effect about something changing the axis of the Earth, the middle of the Earth. And I can't remember all the details, but in the last few years, I've had just this feeling of having a large, really durable raft available. And I keep telling people, I mean, everybody knows that knows me that I'm very different and spiritual or mysterious.
Catherine, do you sense something big is going to happen?
I just feel that there's this overwhelmingness of change happening. I don't know if it's deep consciousness or there's just so much more than what we think we know. And I mean, I can't get politically all into it, but I went to a retreat in Mount Shasta a few years back, too. And that was a compelling time for me, too. I had felt things that I have never felt before.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot that's going on there. Linda, we're running out of time for this half, but
yeah,
go ahead.
What's interesting about red lights is that some people have interaction with red lights specifically that can blink, can move, can hover, can move around in rooms, and they feel tremendous negativity, that there is something harmful. While other people will have encounters with not necessarily always red, but with lights that move around in a house, in a yard, in a car, and apparently, as you felt, they don't feel threat. They feel some sort of friendship, may be too strong a word, but something non-threatening and something that at least is interested in them as humans. And this is the, to me, this is one of the most difficult parts of the whole phenomena, is that humans have a bell-shaped curve of so many different interactions, positive and negative, with craft, lights, beams. It's very difficult to understand why there is not some sort of singular flavor or sense of agenda. Why is it that there are so many mixed signals? And right now, if you jump over to the human side of things, I would say that there is a predominant feeling among people in the abduction syndrome that they are waiting for a large shoe to drop related to something happening on this planet that is yet to unfold.
Do you feel that way too, Linda?
I do.
Yeah, me too.
Very strongly.
I can't put my finger on it, but there's something there.
Yeah. And in upcoming conferences this year, I'm going to be in Eureka Springs in the Inn of the Ozarks, April 11th to 13th.
I'll be there.
Yeah, that's right. I was just going to say, we're going to be there. I'm going to be sharing more about my trip to the 12,000-year-old Göbekli Tepe, Turkey, and combine it with what whistleblower leaks have been telling me about ET self-activating technologies on this planet, past, present, and possibly future. And I'm going to extend that into even more presentations, lectures, and workshops upcoming in something that is new, brand new, and it sounds like it's going to be very interesting and fun. It's called Modern Knowledge Tour 2014. I'm going to be in Toronto, Ontario, Canada, at the Ontario Science Center there, and I will be there with like Rich Dolan and Michael Tellinger. Stanton Friedman will be on some of these. There's going to be different cities of different speakers for a period of time in June in Canada. So I'll be speaking at the Ontario Science Center on June 6th and at the MUFON conference in Cherry Hills, New Jersey in July, the 18th to the 20th. So for people who are interested in the work that I'm doing related to ancient terraforming Göbekli Tepe and intelligences on this planet, go to earthfiles.com and right at the top of the headlines page are the hot links to registration and information.
When we come back, those of you who have been on hold, just stay there. I'll get to you as quickly as possible. Linda, in terms of some of your older works, Alien Harvest and A Strange Harvest, are they still available to people?
My books and documentaries are always available at earthfiles.com in the Earth Files shop.
All right, that's the way to do it. And if you need to email me, that's george@coasttocoastam.com. If you're not liking us on Facebook, do so. And also follow us on Twitter. You can do both by going to coasttocoastam.com, far right-hand corner, click those two icons, and you'll get to us that way as well. We're going to come right back. We'll start in with you, Kyle, truck driving in Kentucky, in just a moment. Well, on our next Coast to Coast program, off to Denver for the Beyond Belief television shows. Dave Schrader filling in for me tomorrow night. So make sure you're part of that program. And we're going to come back in a moment with Linda Moulton Howe and take your final calls here on Coast to Coast Day Out. Okay, welcome back to Linda Moulton Howe's Hour. Let's go to Kyle, truck driving in Kentucky, as promised. Hey, Kyle, thanks for holding on so long.
No problem. Good morning, George and Linda.
Morning.
Hi. It's a pleasure to talk to both of you. I got a short story to tell you. My ex-father-in-law lived in southern Illinois out in the Shawnee Forest, and his property was completely surrounded by almost 2,000 acres of the Shawnee Forest. There was no other private land. And we went for a hike one evening, and we were probably about a mile away from the house on a hilltop. And we were looking out into the northwestern sky, and there was a pale green light behind the cloud coverage, and it was moving in an S-shaped pattern, repeating just back and forth behind the clouds. And after it had went back and forth four or five times, it was like it rotated out from behind the clouds. Gradually, you saw a little bit of the light, and it just kept showing more and more of itself. Until it was almost hurt your eyes. It was so bright. And then it rotated back behind the clouds just as it had rotated out. And then it continued that S-shaped pattern maybe till it was about 10 o'clock or so in the sky. And then it just disappeared. Now, if that wasn't strange enough, we had been drinking, but we were by no means drunk. And we had three cans of beer left when we went back to the house. And I put them in the fridge. And the next morning when we woke up, I went to get something out of the fridge, and them cans of beer were gone. And we went out on the property later that evening, and in the same spot where we were when we were watching that light, there was three empty cans of beer sitting there. Neither one of us remembers going back out there. And it's not like either one of us to have left them cans. Neither one of us litters. So we can't explain how they got out there or what happened.
Well, Whitley Strieber has always talked about the sense of humor of the intelligence he dealt with. Even though he was terrified lots of time, he did come to say, we're dealing with intelligences, at least some of them, that have a sense of humor. And that there have been all kinds of what they call the displacement phenomena, where people are convinced that something literally took, like in this case, the beer cans away, and then objects will be returned at some place, in a car, in a house, in a boat. And the people know that they didn't do this, and that the only link is to the light or the beam or the missing time or something interacting. So it's very possible that you are in that category. But if I'm hearing you, you are saying that you and your friends, you don't have any memory of interacting directly with a beam of light or something that was glowing and having missing time.
No, there was no missing time per se. We only seen the light directly for the brief moment when it came out from behind the clouds. But for that moment, it was really bright. I distinctly remember putting them last three cans of beer in the fridge when we went back to the house. Now, whether or not we went back out and we don't remember it, or something else took them cans of beer out of the fridge, I couldn't say.
Well, the trickster tradition is along these same lines, that other humans over centuries have noticed a trickster sort of relationship with things that have been called fairies or mythology. But in fact, it could be that we are dealing with other intelligences from somewhere else in the cosmos who have a good sense of humor, and that sometimes humans are played with in these ways.
Okay, let's go to Becky now in Maui in Hawaii, west of the Rockies, way west. Hi, Becky.
Aloha.
You too.
I love seeing you guys on the Ancient Aliens programs.
Thank you.
I just love it. Yeah, I have an interesting story. I'm an astronomer here on Maui. I conduct astronomy at resorts. And I meet a lot of people from all over the world, astronauts, people who work for NASA, people who build satellites, all kinds of interesting people. And one, just last month, a man at the end of my program, I was packing up my scope, he came up, he was the only one there, and he was telling me how he works near Cheyenne Mountain. And I know a little bit about that. I go, is that where NORAD is? And he goes, yeah. And he said, my friend works for NORAD. And he said, We started talking, and I was asking him all kinds of questions, and got into the subject of UFOs, because I love that topic. And he said, oh, yeah, his friend told him that for the cattle mutilations that this big controversy is about, he said, they actually take these silent helicopters and they take the animals, they take them to labs, they do the tests, and they drop them from like 2,000 feet from these helicopters, like back where they took them. And I go, why would they do that? And he was talking about like underground, like toxic waste sites or things like that where they test the animals to see if, you know, how they're, you know, the pastures that they're on, if it's contaminating them or, and they just don't want the public to know about it. And it was just like a very interesting conversation to have. And I didn't know. I mean, it doesn't surprise me. I could totally see our military or, you know, doing that, but didn't know about it.
And Becky, do you head up the Maui Astronomy Club still?
Yes.
I know people who know you.
Oh, my God.
You have fun out there.
Oh, yeah. It's awesome here.
Anyways, go ahead, Linda.
Yeah. I love astronomy, too. I think it's you're dealing with just a more modern spin on muddying the waters. You have to keep the facts of the timeline about animal mutilations always front and center whenever there's any explanation that is given about this is who and this is why and that mutilations are some paramilitary or government operation.
Yeah.
The earliest case that I know about and talked with a producer at the BBC in London about this in the fall of 1979, and he told me that they had had a journal from Australia about the discovery in an Australian billabong of 104 sheep in the year 1911, in which the ear, the eye, the tongue, the jaw, the flesh, the genitals, and the rectum had all been excised bloodlessly in all these sheep. And that from that point on, the link would then go back to the beginning of that century, 1911, and a link to the UFO phenomena. Now, when you jump from 1911 up to the 1950s, 60s, when I have read newspaper archives of the same bloodless, trackless animal mutilations taking place in various parts of the United States that early, and then you come to September of 1967, that's the famous horse in southern Colorado, that was definitely linked to the presence of UFOs and discs and little airplanes that were dissolving into clouds and all kinds of high strangeness in 67. So you have 67 back to 1911 as a period of time in which the animal mutilations, same MO, bloodless, no tracks around the bodies, same tissue taken. Therefore, any explanation in 2014 of some modern military or paramilitary operation doesn't in any way, shape, or form explain all of the mutilation cases in 1911 to 1967.
Linda, what do you see with everything you've investigated over the years? What seems to be the most pressing issue to date? What's out there?
What's happening to our own planet?
Yeah.
And I mean this quite literally. We are in the sixth mass extinction. We humans are killing Earth life at a rate that is just astonishing. And in the process, if we're not careful, we're going to end up destroying ourselves. That is the biggest problem on the planet. Extraterrestrials, other dimensions, different timelines, they may have interactions with this planet because we are close to destroying ourselves. And what a sad tragedy I think that would be, because as mixed as humans are emotionally and mentally in every other way, there is something about this creature allegedly made by extraterrestrials, that in its soul and its spirit, there is strength that maybe others do not have, and in our ability to create. I think that we are something that is astonishing even to those that allegedly made us from the extraterrestrial side.
Richard's in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Welcome to Coast, Richard.
Hello, yeah. Lyndon Moulton-Howe and George.
Hi, Richard.
Yeah, I had three close encounters, and ever since that, I have some prophetic dreams. I don't have them anymore, but all the clues came over Coast to Coast in my one dream.
Huh.
The one dream was about the Pakistani-Indian earthquake, which happened like several years ago.
Have you had dreams?
And then I don't know.
Have you had dreams recently about anything coming?
Yes, I had a continuation of that earthquake dream, that there was going to be an atomic blast off one of the coasts or on one of the coasts, and then it was going to devastate the United States. And after that, I just woke up.
Well, I'm glad you did. Dreams are pretty prophetic. There's no question about that. The big question is what causes them, and do these things occur thereafter? And lots of people lately, Linda, are dreaming strange dreams.
Yes, and we have this ghost MH370 that is now going to go down in Earth history, if nothing more comes about, as truly one of the strangest, we'll call it matter world disappearances on record. And that if some of the speculation has been that somebody still has that airplane in Pakistan or someplace, and they're trying to turn it into a bomb carrier, and that all of the rest of this is to divert attention from that,
yeah.
then we are at an extremely dangerous time, because when will this be dropped, literally and figuratively? If it's something else, even is it possible that it falls into the category of the Kinross Air Force Base eyewitnesses who saw an F-89 be engulfed by a UFO in 1951 over Michigan, Lake Superior, Michigan, and the famous Frederick Valentich case off the coast of Melbourne in Australia, where there was chatter with traffic control when he and his Piper Cub literally disappeared in the context of a UFO there, too. And it was interesting that J. Allen Hynek told me himself that he had heard the traffic control, the audio tape that they had recorded of the conversation with Frederick Valentich and the tower, and that right at the end, when he was describing this big, huge light coming straight at his Piper Cub, I believe he was flying, that J. Allen Hynek said that the sound suddenly went, and this was J. Allen Hynek's description, these are his words, that it sounded like soup cans rolling around in the bottom of an empty oil drum, quote unquote. And those two cases are out there with the eyewitnesses, traffic control, all kinds of things, military eyewitnesses, and they sort of are like pins on a map that this has happened in the past. Can this phenomena pluck airplanes out of the sky, such as the 777? There is absolutely no proof in any direction right now, as we are speaking in the early morning of the 28th of March. After 3 weeks, the very lack of a coherent focus on what seemed to be evidence for any explanation that's still lacking is amazing.
Sure. It's like they're on a wild goose chase or something.
Well, if it is phenomena, that might explain why.
Yeah. I mean, they're beginning to find debris, but You know, I at this point, how do you know somebody didn't dump something there to send them off on a different tangent?
Well, it's becoming winter. And that part, when you go that far west, southwest of Perth, at this time of the year, the weather is erratic. The seas are churning. The idea that anybody could salt something in that part of the world, I think they're underestimating that of all of the places on the planet where it would be difficult to do anything, it's southwest of Perth as the Antarctic in that part of the world is moving into winter.
Erica, truck driving in Arizona. Only have about a minute, Erica. Go ahead.
Hi, Linda and George. I just wanted to say that my daughter was born 3 months after the Three Mile Island in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And that morning, I woke up feeling very ill, extremely sick, so sick that I picked up the phone to call the doctor. I had a doctor's appointment that day, and I wanted to reschedule it because I felt so sick. And the phones were dead. And I remember it was in the morning. It was right around 10 o'clock. The Price is Right was on. The next thing I know, the door knocked, and it was my husband who was stationed in Fort Bragg, well, actually on Pope Air Force Base. He appeared at the door, and I said, well, what are you doing here? He says, well, I come to get you. There's a meltdown. And I said, a meltdown of what? I mean, we were all sitting ducks in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania.
Oh, my gosh, what a story that
was. That's right.
Linda, we are out of time. Let's keep in touch. I'll see you at the Ozark UFO conference.
All right.
All right, Linda Moulton Howe. Her website, of course, earthfiles.com. You can send her an email, by the way, at earthfiles@earthfiles.com. Don't forget Dave Schrader sitting in for me on the Friday show. I'll be back Monday right after our Denver TV tapings, and I'll be live out of St. Louis. For Nathan Staton, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Borles, George Knapp, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.